Anyway, John Gough. You may not have heard of John Gough. Not a lot of people have. I first came across him when I was researching the life of George Birkbeck, who was the 19th century doctor and educationalist, who was born in Settle. He was prominent in the development of adult education in the 19th century and sort of credited with the development of the Mechanics Institute movement. And some of you may remember that I gave a talk to this group about Birkbeck a few years ago. And in that talk I said that during the time that Birkbeck was living with an uncle in Sedbergh, he had come into contact with three very remarkable men. And these three very remarkable men were, well, one was a guy called John Dawson, who was a general practitioner and surgeon in Sedbergh, and who was also a renowned mathematician, and he taught Birkbeck maths. Another was John Gough, who I'm going to talk about, whom Birkbeck got to know through relatives in Kendal while he was living in Sedbergh. And the third one was John Dalton. And so three of them were Johns. So that led me to doing a talk for the Craven Youth Career Stories of Scientists group called Three Johns. And then I realised that our John Gough had been taught mathematics by a guy called John Slee, so it sort of became Four Johns. And through Gough, I became interested in another blind mathematician, a man called Nicholas Saunderson, who became Lucasian professor at Cambridge, in spite of being blind from about 1 year old. And that also became a topic for a Craven Youth Re-A lecture. But through researching Nicholas Saunderson, it renewed my fascination in John Gough. So he's been described as the blind philosopher. Anyway, as a result of that, I looked further into his life and managed to bulk it out a bit and into a full talk in its own right, and hence this talk tonight. So here he is. He was born on the 17th of January in 1757. He was the eldest son of Nathan and Susanna Gough. Nathan was a shearman and a dyer in Kendal. And the occupation of a shearman did not mean, as you might think, that he sheared sheep. He sheared cloth. He cut off the loose threads and nubs and slubs off the surface of cloth. So he would have been a fabric finisher. And he was the son of a Thomas Gough, who came from Wyresdale in Lancashire, who had been a skinner and glover, so in a not too dissimilar type of trade. And Susanna, John's mother, she was the eldest daughter of a man called John Wilson, who was described as being a respectable yeoman. And he had a good estate on the west bank of Windermere. So he was born into a family of reasonable means. Not a wealthy family, but of reasonable means. But before he was 3 years old, he caught smallpox. And as a result of that, he lost his sight. He became almost totally blind. This wasn't by any means unusual. In sort of 18th century Europe, a third of those infected with smallpox lost their sight. And a third of all instances of blindness were from smallpox. In many of our lifetimes here, certainly in mine, smallpox was still a great killer in the world, and it was only in 1980 that the World Health Organization reckoned that it had been eradicated. At the time of John Gough's birth, somewhere between 1 in 7 and 1 in 10 children could be expected to die from smallpox. And of those who didn't die, the chances are they were going to lose their sight. What happened was the retina became ulcerated and infected, and that was the end of it as far as the sight was concerned. Our John survived smallpox, but the sight in the left eye was destroyed completely, and the right eye was so badly damaged that he could tell night from day, but he couldn't distinguish colours, he couldn't make out shapes, but he could see enough light that he knew whether it was day or night. Later in life he remembered one or two things before he was three. He claimed to remember seeing the procession of Kendall Guild in 1759, when he would only have been about 2.5, but apparently it made a great impression upon him. He'd been taken up to an upstairs room so he could look down on the procession passing by, and he was terrified. As a small child, he was terrified by the noise and the colour and the bustle of it, and he ran off and hid under the bedclothes in one of the bedrooms. It was a particularly big guild procession that year. It had been held every 21 years, and that year it was said in the local paper, I think it was, I found this quote, it was said to have been carried on to such an extravagant height that many of the tradesmen were ruined by the expenses of the procession. But fortunately that didn't seem to be the case with Nathan Gough. John also remembered seeing an earthworm in the garden, which is a bit strange, but we'll come to that in a minute. We can imagine that as a small child with no sight, the time must have dragged for him, and in the early days after him becoming blind, he often became very disturbed and upset, particularly by noises. Any sort of noise upset him, which you can imagine. Basically because he didn't know where they were coming from, he didn't know what was causing them, and they really upset him, and he didn't sleep well. He suffered from vivid dreams. Even though he had no sight, the dreams he had were quite vivid. Gradually though, he sort of realised the importance of hearing in a sightless world, and when he was about 4 years old, he was sitting on a window seat apparently, and somebody gave him a hammer or a lump of wood to play with, and he banged it on the seat, and the penny suddenly dropped with him that this was the same noise that he'd been hearing that had been upsetting him, which was carpenters working in an adjoining house hammering. And when this was explained to him and the ears could realise that the noise he was making was the same one that he'd been frightened of, things began to get better. He began to explore everything around him by touch and examine everything that he could get hold of in great detail. And I think he was fortunate that his parents and other members of the family and friends sort of encouraged him to do this. He might have been a child that was told, don't touch that, you might break it or whatever, but he was encouraged to do this, and they explained what it was that he was handling and what it might be used for. And on one occasion, he was out with his father, and this is the occasion of the earthworm. His father was fishing, and he put an earthworm into young John's hand, and it was a sort of eureka moment. He felt at it and remembered having seen an earthworm in the garden, and this tale he related throughout his life. So, as I say, he was fortunate in that parents and friends put things into his hands for him to examine, and they would describe what they were and any purpose they may have, and tell them what they were, and he would remember the names. So, and he was a persistent questioner. You can imagine, you know, a young child, what is it, Daddy? What does it do? What's it made of? You know, why does it feel like this? And his father, in particular, spent a lot of time explaining the animal kingdom to him. He was interested in animals, although I don't suppose he remembered seeing any. And by the time he was 4.5, he understood the classification of animals. He knew that they were divided. This was the classification at the time. They were divided into quadrupeds, into birds, fishes, serpents, insects, and crustaceous and testaceous animals. Those were the standard classifications. And when at some time a travelling menagerie, and maybe it was the animals associated with a circus, maybe came to Kendall, his father took him to hear the animals, and he persuaded the keepers to let John handle or at least touch all the animals. well, almost so. They wouldn't let him touch the hyenas for some. I can't understand why, but anyway, he was allowed to touch and stroke all the other animals, which was a great thrill. So he was very fortunate in that his family encouraged him to explore the world with the senses that he had left, and he wasn't left to sit in a corner. In the summer of 1761, when he was still only 4 and a half, he was somehow got to know an old man and a son who were both musicians. He must have been taken by somebody to see them. And they both played the violin, and the son also played the German flute. And John would sit and listen to them and be quite mesmerised by the music and listen very intently. A German flute, I think, at that time was just a transverse flute. Flutes before that had been like recorders, straight down. And the old man reckoned that John had a really good ear for music, and they wanted to try and teach him the violin. But the lessons didn't get very far at all, because his father's religious principles and scruples soon put a stop to them. Nathan Goth was a member of the Society of Friends, and at that time, among some Quakers at least, music was regarded as frivolous, and playing the violin or fiddling was particularly so because it was associated with dancing. I think this was a great shame, because in all probability John would have gained a lot of pleasure during his lifetime if he'd been allowed to learn a musical instrument. So he couldn't learn a musical instrument, and it was decided that something was needed to provide him with something to occupy his time, but they couldn't decide exactly what, and it took quite a lot of thinking about, and it wasn't until he was 6 years old that he was sent to the Quaker school in Kendal, which is it was just through that arch in Stamengate in Kendal. That's a recent photograph, but I think the building is still there. And the master there was a man called Mr. Rebanks, and he was to learn Latin. For a young boy of six to have to learn Latin, he wasn't able to read because he couldn't see the page. So one of the classmates had to read out the rules of Latin grammar that he had to memorise. And he clearly had a very good memory that comes out in a lot. I mean, you wouldn't have known what he did if he hadn't had a really good memory. But it was painfully slow, and it was 6 years with Rebanks, and he learned very little, only a trifling amount. And then Rebanks retired, and he was replaced by a man called Bewley. Now, Mr. Bewley was a completely different kettle of fish to Rebanks. He was obviously a much better teacher, and under him, John began to make quite rapid progress with his Latin. And he also came to admire the lives of illustrious Romans through the writings of the Roman biographer Cornelius Nepos, who he seemed to be very fond of, who obviously must have been read aloud to him, maybe by one of the other students. And Bewley is described in what I've read as being a classicist, but like most well-educated men of the time, he was pretty well-read in the branches of natural philosophy as well, and what we would know now as the sciences. So, jumping back a bit, I've already spoken about John's early interest in animals, and he had access to a few books about them that family and friends read to him. But when he was about eight, he was taken to visit an elderly couple who had some potted plants on a windowsill. And he was attracted to one of them, which was a Moldovan balm, which had a strong smell. And he found his way to this plant, and he began to feel his way up the stem to the leaves. And again, I think he was fortunate, nobody said, "Don't touch that, John, because you'll knock it over." But he felt through the leaves and compared it to another plant which is in a pot next to it. And it sparked off an interest in plants. And he found that if he'd minutely examined a specimen once, when anybody presented it to him again, he could recognise it. And if somebody told him what it was, he could remember the names. It was quite a few years later, when he was about 12, that he actually developed a sort of systematic study of botany, because his father had taken his sister and him out into the fields, and John was deeply absorbed in examining a plant growing in the field, which was a specimen of henbane. And he then, his father then gathered a selection of other wildflowers around and put them into his hands, and told him, as far as he knew, what they were. And he also told him, oh, there's a book which will tell you all the names and descriptions of them. And this book was this one. It was a book by John Wilson, A Synopsis of British Plants. This John Wilson was no relation whatsoever to the John Wilson who was Susanna's father, but he was an interesting character because he actually came from Kendal by chance, and his father had all, I understand his father already had a copy of the book, which he showed to John and read to him. But Wilson was quite an interesting character. He'd been a shoemaker and a baker, and he was also the first man to attempt to make a systematic classification of, in English, of British indigenous plants. And our John didn't rest until he'd mastered all of the technical terms and the system of classification that people read out to him from this book. And then he started a small botany group, or a botany club, with his schoolmates. And they would go out collecting plants, and John would feel them and identify them while one of the boys read from the book. So he learned quite a lot there with his schoolmates. He then got hold of another book, this one, Hudson's Flora Anglica, and this was based on Linnaeus's classification of plants, and this became his favourite book at the time. And he got into correspondence with people, obviously people wrote letters for him, and he got in correspondence with a Dr. William Withering, who was the author of a book at the time, Arrangement of Plants. I don't think that had anything to do with flower arranging or floral art, but how plants were classified. And our John's system of examining plants was that he would hold them by the root in one hand, and then he'd work his fingers up the stem, and he'd check the arrangement of the leaves, whether they were opposite or alternate or in fours or whatever. And then he would draw them over his tongue and his lips to see whether they were hairy or spiky or smooth. So if he could detect any hairiness or down on the stems. And when he came to the flower, he would put the tip of his tongue into the flower and examine the stamen and the pistils, and if it was too small, he'd get one of his schoolmates or whoever was with him to examine it with a lens and read out from the book so they could tell what it was. And whoever was reading also made notes for him. He had some very helpful friends and relatives. So he became very adept at identifying plants. And he also became very adept at identifying animals and birds, dead ones that were brought to him, which he examined in a similar sort of way. Some years later, Coleridge referred to him in an essay he wrote on. Coleridge wrote this essay called "The Soul and Organs of Sense," the soul and its organs of sense. And he wrote this, which I'll read out, because he says, "The every way amiable and estimable John Gough of Kendal is not only an excellent mathematician, which he was by the time Coleridge wrote this, but an infallible botanist and zoologist. He has frequently, at first field, corrected the mistakes of the most experienced sportsmen with regard to the vermin or birds which they had killed, when it chanced to be a variety or rare species, so completely resembling the common one, that it required a great steadiness of observation to detect the difference, even after it had been pointed out. As to plants and flowers, the rapidity of his touch appears fully equal to that of sight, and the accuracy greater." So he had obviously had quite a reputation in botany and identifying animals. He also appears in one of Wordsworth's books, a work called The Excursion. At about 15 years old, he had a book read to him called Physico-Theology by William Dearham. This sort of broadened his view. It gave him a much wider view of the world and its inhabitants, both human and animal. And this book also introduced him to some of the Latin and Greek poets that he was already interested in, sort of classical literature, and which led him on to the English poets like Shakespeare and Goldsmith and so on. And many of the poems, after they'd been read to him, he could memorise them and he could recite them back some 40 or 50 years later. So, I've read that he began doing some experimental work using his father's dye house as a laboratory. But what exactly he did and how he did it, I'm not sure. But he carried on his interest in plants and animals. And nothing, but, you know, he got into perhaps a bit of a rut. Nothing really grabbed his attention until one day when he was by now about 18, somebody gave him a set of puzzling rings. You know the sort of thing, you've got 9 or 10 rings and they're all interlocked and you've got to work out how to get them apart. And he worked at this for hours and hours and hours, because he couldn't see them, he was only going by feel. And in the end, after several hours playing about with them, he eventually separated the 9 rings. And what struck him was not so much the fact that he'd got them apart, but the permutations that he'd had to use to do it, because as you know, you've got to have a sort of routine with these sort of things. You turn this one over there, you turn this one back and put it to here, and just keep working it. And it was the permutations that he'd had to use to separate them that sort of began his fascination with mathematics. Some years later, he said that he learned arithmetic at home by a contrivance of his own, which was nearly like that used by Dr. Saunderson that I referred to at the start. And this refers to that Nicholas Saunderson. He was a guy from Thurlston near Penistone, and he'd lost his sight. It was about 70 years before John Gough's time when he'd lost his sight. And as I say, he became Lucasian professor at which was a post previously held by Isaac Newton and subsequently by Charles Babbage and more recently by Stephen Hawking. So in a distinguished line of people. Well, it's a bit of a diversion really. But his new interest in mathematics was that John now persuaded his father to enrol him as a pupil with John Slee. I mentioned John Slee was his teacher. And at some time in 1778, when our John was 21, Gough went to live under Slee's roof in Mungrisdale. I can't find a photograph, I wouldn't be a photograph, but I can't find an image of John Slee anyway, so you'll have to make do with an image of Mungrisdale, where he lived. Those of you who don't know Mungrisdale, it's a little hamlet tucked away off the Penrith to Keswick Road. Very good pub there, the Mill Inn. They do good meals there. Rosemary and I had a few good meals at the Mill Inn before I knew it had any connection with John Slee. You might ask how John knew of John Slee and his reputation as a mathematician, but Slee's family were also Quakers, and the Goths would probably have heard of them, quite possibly met them through quarterly Quaker meetings. And John studied with him for about 18 months. One of the sources of information about Gough is a book called The Annals of Kendal, and in that there's a reference to a letter written by John Slee to a friend regarding John Gough. And he says in this, "He produced a board of rectangular form on which lines were drawn at equal distances, most horizontally and laterally. At the intersections of these lines, the board was pierced with so many small holes so as to receive the lower points of pegs or pins fitted to sink into them. The upper parts of these pins were of so many different forms as we use for digits for numerical calculations, and a considerable number of each kind of these pins were put into so many different compartments in a narrow drawer made for the purpose. It's not difficult with this contrivance to see how it would be practicable for him to perform all the common operations of arithmetic." So, and he was now prepared to extend his inquiries to other subjects connected with maths, and such as geometry and algebra. And here again, this mechanical apparatus came in. In geometry, squares, rectangles, triangles and polygons were exhibited by putting a thread round the pins. And for algebra, he had some pins that represented A, B, C, X, Y, Z, which were symbols in common use then, as they are now. These ordinary substitutes for quantities, he says, known and unknown, can be made available. And this board was no doubt the contrivance similar to that of Dr. Saunderson that Gough spoke about. Now, this was a picture of Saunderson's contrivance, which again was a board. The lines, of course, he couldn't see. It's the position of the holes that were on the crossover points of all those dots. And there, those represent the numbers that it... And that's... after Saunderson's death, people had great difficulty working out how he worked out to it. But I must emphasise that it was similar to Saunderson's, but it wasn't the same, because I, researching Saunderson, I found that Saunderson represented his numbers like this. That's the blank section, a section of nine holes in the pattern, gave you an area where zero could be represented by a large pin in the middle, and one was a small pin in the middle, two had a small pin above a big one, and then they went round. Three was here, four was there, five down here, and so on. It wasn't the same, but it would seem that our John got his inspiration from this. So you can see, when you come back to the numbers and where you've got them, where I've highlighted the holes in here, obviously that one has come right round the clock, so that's nine, that one's four, and so on. For geometry, this was Saunderson's contrivance, where he's put the pins in and then stretched threads between them, so he could make, well, polygons, almost circles, triangles, rectangles, and so on. So they had very similar ideas than that. So he was able to do geometry with threads, threaded round pins. The account went on to say he became acquainted with the principles and elements of maths, and in the prosecution of these subjects he manifested much talent and had a peculiar interest in prediction for the different branches of science. So he returned home after the time he'd spent with Slee, and he had a knowledge of conic sections, mechanics, and some knowledge of fluxions. Now, fluxions were Newton's version of calculus. At Newton's time, Newton had one version of calculus, and Leibniz, who was a sort of contemporary of Newton, had another one, which is more of the calculus we know today. But once back in Kendal, he was determined to pursue his interest in fluxions and calculus. But he had to have somebody who could read to him from textbooks. And instead of having anybody who could get within the family to do it, his sister Dorothy was nominated as to be the reader. So she was very tied to John as his reader. And that allowed him to continue his study of mathematics, but also he began to do investigations and find articles and read about a wide sweep of science as well. And around 1781, John came into contact with this man, John Dalton. John, when he met him, was a young man. John Dalton was a cousin of George Bewley, who was the teacher at the Quaker School, who inspired our John when he was young. And John Dalton had an elder brother, Jonathan. I find it odd that there was a John and a Jonathan in the same family, but Jonathan was teaching at the school that Bewley had at the Quaker School, because John Dalton, of course, was a Quaker, which is why he never went to an English university. At 15, years old, John Dalton came to work with his brother. Whether Bewley had died by this time or moved on, I don't know, but this advert that I found does demonstrate that it was... I'll read it out, it's very faint. At Kendal in Westmorland, youth are boarded and carefully instructed by Jonathan and John Dalton, successors to George Bewley, on the following terms. Board, exclusive of washing per annum, £14. English and writing, £1.10. Arithmetic, merchant's accounts, Latin and French, 2 guineas. And Greek and the mathematics, £3. So there they were, successor to John Bewley, and advertising their school there in obviously a boarding school as well, as they're offering board. I found it difficult to tease out the precise relationship between Gough and Dalton. There are some accounts that say that Gough taught Dalton Latin and Greek, and that Dalton helped Gough by reading to him, writing for him, and drawing diagrams. But if you go to Dalton's biography, it says that he was proficient in Latin by the age of 14. But that when he came into contact with our John Gough, he acquired a great deal of scientific knowledge from him. So there'd obviously be some mutual exchange, but... whatever, Dalton was in Kendal for quite a number of years, and during that time he and John Gough formed quite a firm friendship. Later in life, John Dalton described John Gough as being a prodigy in scientific attainments. In around 1790, when he was in his early 30s, our John began to publish papers, and they were often in the form of letters which he sent to the Manchester Lick and Fill Society. And later he wrote papers for a journal called the Journal of Natural Philosophy, Chemistry and the Arts, which was commonly known as Nicholson's Journal, having been founded and edited by William Nicholson. This is Nicholson's Journal. This was a commercial production, and it was produced as a sort of counter to the transactions of the Royal Society. And so it was popular with people who weren't members of the Royal Society and therefore didn't have access to the transactions. And it only ran from 1797 to about 1813. But it attracted contributions from very well-known scientists, some of whom we would know today, like Humphrey Davy, Henry Cavendish, Alexander von Humboldt, as well as John Gough. Unsurprisingly for a blind man, John produced a large number of papers on sound. One significant piece of work that he did was an investigation of the method by which men judge by sound, judge by the ear, the position of sonorous bodies relative to their own person. So he was sort of some form of echolocation or sonar, I suppose. And one of his most interesting pieces of work was an investigation into the properties of natural rubber, or caoutchouc, if I pronounce that right. It's a peculiar word, is that. This was the written as a letter, the article that he wrote. And he was first person to describe that there was heat released when a rubber band is quickly stretched. So if you stretch a rubber band, it gets warm. He detected the heat with his lips when he stretched it and pressed the band to his lips. And when stretched rubber is heated, it contracts again, which is a reversal of the normal thing you would expect with materials which would expand when they were heated. And these results, as I say, were published by the Manchester Literary and Philosophical Society in 1804. And some years later, James Joule, who we've mostly heard of, undertook his own investigations into rubber and elasticity and the energy changes that occurred. And he specifically referred to John Gough's earlier studies, and the effect became known as the Gough-Joule effect. So his name survives in this rather esoteric subject. Here's a. I've just put up a list of some of the papers that he did. I'm not expecting you to read them, but I'll just go through some of them to give you an idea of what they were. Reasons for supposing that the lakes had been more numerous than they are at present, with an attempt to assign the causes whereby they have been defaced. Experiments and observation on the vegetation of seeds. The theory of compound sounds. There's the one on India rubber, but a reply to Mr. Dalton's objections to a theory on mixed gases. This is interesting as well. Observations on the ebbing and flowing well at Giggleswick in the West Riding of Yorkshire, with a theory of reciprocating fountains. I don't know how many of you know the ebbing and flowing well at Giggleswick, but some of you will. It's as you go up onto Booker Brow from the Settle side on the right hand side, and I've been there several times and I've not seen it ebbing and flowing, but it doesn't seem to perform as much these years. Remarks on the summer birds of passage and on migration in general. On the supposed revival of insects after a long immersion in wine or other intoxicating liquor. Instances of suspended animation in vegetables, and facts and observations to explain the curious phenomenon of ventriloquisms. So it goes on and on and on. The art of writing in the dark, which would have been all the same to him, I suppose. A narrative of some less common effects of lightning. So an absolutely amazing scope of subjects that he wrote on. Anyway, I'm now going to come to an incident that I find quite fascinating. In 1825, a man called Thomas Wilkinson, who was a landowner living up in the Northern Lakes, he published a book entitled Tours to the British Mountains, which you can still get hold of. And in this, there's a chapter on Blencathra, or Saddleback, near Keswick, not far from Mungleisdale actually, and he climbed this with a party that included John Gough. There's Blencathra, you see the saddleback shape on the top. He doesn't give a date for the climb, but it's also recorded that Wordsworth read the manuscript for him about 20 years before it was actually published. So the walk must have been sometime when Gough was about in his 40s. I can't do better than to read a section verbatim again, but he writes, I was once spending a few days at the foot of Blencathra. A party of six of us on a midsummer morning set off at 4 o'clock. To two of these individuals, the ascent of such a high and rugged mountain might have seemed impractical. The lame and the blind, without extraordinary minds, would not have hazarded the attempt amid the rocky steeps of this mountain. But the company of genius and science was courted and not withheld on the occasion. And the first that was seen standing on the summit of the mountain was the lame, leaning on his crutch and staff. To the blind, i.e. John Gough, I attempted a description of the fearful precipices beneath us. But it was the first thing that I repented of that day, when I saw him fall on the ground with dizziness and cling to the earth and scream out with the apprehension of tumbling down into the rocks into the abyss below. Till then I thought that the idea of giddiness must be received at the eye. Certainly it was as vivid in the mind of our learned and accomplished companion from what he heard as if he had seen the terrors around him. But we now moderated our descriptions and only talked of the extent and the appearance of distant objects. Interesting that there's this man who had never actually seen a mountain, and then he's told about the precipices and suddenly gets vertigo. It doesn't say whether they climbed up Sharp Edge. I did that last year, and it's a bit like Striding Edge, only maybe a bit worse. But anyway, after they'd climbed Blencathra, they went on to climb Skiddaw. It's interesting, in this book he talks of setting off to climb these various mountains in this tour of the British Mountains in about leaving about 4 o'clock in the morning with a little bit of bread and cheese in their pockets, you know, and that's it, you know. Make sure you've got a good lunch and a waterproof and 3 litres of water and everything like that. So this was when he would be in his 40s sometime. And it was in his 40s that he married. At the age of 43, John married a lady called Mary Harrison from Crossgate near Kendal. And they moved to a house called Middleshaw in Old Hutton. She could only have been about 21 or 22 years old at the time. I know some of this because Debbie did some research on the family farm. I won't say if you've ever got stuck, ask Debbie, because she's got enough to do, I'm sure. I don't know anything about how they came to know each other, but it must have been quite a challenge for, a young woman of that age to take on a blind bachelor more than 20 years her senior, who was no doubt fairly set in his ways. But they must have got on quite well because they had 9 children. They had 4 sons and 5 daughters. And in 1812, Gough had a new house built for them to accommodate the family. And this was on the slope of Benson Knot, which is a hill rising on the north side of Kendal. And the house was called Fowl Inn, which presumably was the field where the fowl were kept, and that's the field on which he built the house. The house is now well within the Kendal conurbation. In 1858, when it must have been about not much changed, it's up here to the sort of northeast of the centre. And in the 1835 town map, it's marked there. So it's still outside the main town at that stage. It's now well within the town. It's rather a fine house, I think. I had some difficulty finding it because I couldn't find a house called Fowling, and then I found it was until recently called Garden House, and it's now been renamed as Wainwright House, and it's run as a bed and breakfast, and it's Grade 2 listed, which isn't really surprising. The ironwork on the front should be listed, if nothing else. I don't know whether John's sister Dorothy lived with them to carry on as his reader, or whether Mary now acted as his reader and writer. I don't know that. But from about this time, about the time they moved to Fowling, he began to teach. And he taught mathematics to quite a select groups of pupils to prepare them for university, and in particular for the mathematics tripos at Cambridge. And many of his pupils achieved very high grades and subsequent prominence. Here are just a couple of the students of John Gough. Joshua King, he became also Lucasian professor in 1839, and William Wellell, who was the master of Trinity College. Joshua King was regarded as probably one of the finest mathematicians of the time. He was senior wrangler at Cambridge. That is, he was the mathematics student who got the highest marks. The William Wewell. I don't know how you pronounce that. Wewell. He was second wrangler as well, and his last pupil, a guy called Thomas Gaskin, was. King succeeded Charles Babbage into the position. These three that I mentioned, they all had reasonably local connections, so I suppose they would know him by local repute. King was born in Lowick, which is between Ulverston and Coniston, he'd been educated at Hawkshead Grammar School. This guy was from Lancaster and attended Lancaster and Heversham grammar schools, and Gaskin went to Sedbergh School. So they would have been reasonably local, although he did have other students from all around the country. I find it quite amazing that for a period of about 20 years, which spanned the end of the beginning of the 19th centuries, completely disproportionate number of the greatest mathematicians and highest scoring students in mathematics passed through the hands of three men tucked away in this part of the northwest of England, between John Gough himself, Gough's teacher John Slee, and John Dawson, the GP from Sedbergh, who became a nationally renowned mathematician. The you know, very high percentage. I didn't work it up. It was something like about 80% of the people who were senior wrangler went through the hands of one or other of those kids, those teachers. In 1823, John Gough's health began to decline, and he had attacks of epilepsy and. Obviously late onset epilepsy, it would seem, and he had increasingly debilitating attacks, and he died fairly soon after that in 1825, and he died at Fowling, and he's buried in Kendal Parish Churchyard. Some 30 years after John's death, his son copied out by hand an autobiography that he'd earlier dictated. And this is in Cumbria County Archive in Kendal. I've been through it, and it's fascinating, but it's very slow reading. The handwriting's not very easy to decipher, but it's a fascinating, a lot of information about Gough's life. After his death, all his papers went to a man described as an intimate friend, who was the Reverend John Harrison. And with the family's approval, the intention was that he was going to produce a publication of all John Gough's collected work. But it was going to be in 2 octavo volumes, but it never happened because they found that the material was too voluminous for publication. There was just too much of it. But what did happen was that there was a memoir of his life produced for this publication I mentioned earlier called The Annals of Kendal, which was published in 1861, written by a guy called Cornelius Nicholson. And this includes sections about all the worthies, the great and the good of Kendal and the surrounding area. It's described as being a historical and descriptive account of Kendal and the neighbourhood, with biographical sketches and many eminent personages connected with the town. And there are other accounts of Gough's life that appear in books like Wilson's Biography of the Blind and Worthies of Cumberland and Westmoreland, but these others, when I've checked through them, they're all just pretty well word for word lifts off the work of Cornelius Nicholson. So there's really only that one source. So that just about wraps up the talk, except to say that being in Kendal earlier this year, I went to Kendal to see the Monet exhibition at Abbot Hall, the exhibition of one Monet. But none the worse of that, because you did concentrate on just looking at the one painting instead of going past them. So I thought that was quite good. So as Abbot Hall is right next door to Kendal Parish Church, as some of you will know, I thought I'll just go and see if I can find John Gough's grave. And I felt thwarted when I found that apart from about 3 headstones, all the headstones had been cleared. And I went in the church and I couldn't find any memorial there. But I just met some ladies coming, I think they were going in to do the Easter decorations, and they told me that a lot of the older gravestones had been laid flat in an area alongside the church. Many of them were badly worn from having been walked over. And I was just about to give up hope when I found this. Now, you can, with these lights on, you can't probably read it, but it's got John Gough there. It's very warm, but it reads, "In memory of John Gough, who died 28th of July 1825, aged 68 years." And below, it's just possible to read the names of Harrison, who was one of his sons, and Dorothy, a daughter. And these had both died aged 5. They predeceased him, but presumably, I don't know whether they were then reburied in that grave, or there was a grave for them that John was then buried in, and they put the stone at that time. So, and there are quite a number of other names further down, but they're just too worn to be able to make them out. Seven children, along with his wife, survived him. One was Thomas Gough, who was born in 1804. He became a surgeon in Kendal. Another son, Nathan, he continued to live with his mother until at least 1851, from the census data. And of the daughters, I've only been able to trace that one was called Mary after her mother, and she became Mary Atkinson. She married a Mr. Atkinson. And one, Anne, who became Anne Bell and moved out of the area to Manchester, and one was Susanna. John's wife Mary continued to live at Fowling and died at the age of 80 in 1858. So, to sum up his life, I'll just go back to what Cornelius Nicholson wrote in the Annals of Kendal. It says, "It may be said of Mr. Gough that though not to him returned day, or the sweet approach of even or morn, or sight of vernal bloom, or summer's rose, still at every stage of life had its enjoyments. Every change of season brought a change of employment. Every day presented his fingers with novelties from nature's endless territories, his mind with germs of thought from the vast storehouse of knowledge. Resignation was a prominent feature of his character, i.e. was resigned to his loss of sight. The inconveniences attendant on his loss of sight never elicited an expression of murmur, and to ennui, early or late in life, he was a stranger. For his mind fed on thoughts harmonious, that dissipated clouds of difficulty and changed ever during dark into hours of cheerfulness and mental sunshine. To be always employed, he knew well, was essential to his happiness, and no toil was too much to accomplish. Without saying, then, to inquire how far his success may have depended upon the inherent strength of intellectual powers, we have a striking instance of the necessity of self-reliance and self-culture in breaking down every impediment, however much aided by physical imperfections, which may stand in the way of progress. By others, therefore, be they placed in more or less favoured circumstances, the subject of this memoir, i.e. John Gough, and his achievements are worthy of remembrance. For knowledge is to be acquired by labour alone. There is want only where no firm will exists, where no adequate efforts are made." Which I thought was rather a nice tribute to him. It's a good eulogy. So that's John Gough. I found him very interesting to research. I hope you found him interesting to hear about.